It was somewhere between my sophomore and junior year in high school. I was at a Christian summer camp with the rest of my friends from my church, and we were having a blast all week. It was a great time. I'd lost my voice and could not talk at all by the time we got toward the end of that week. But something else was happening inside of me. Something was stirring in my soul. Something was changing, or needed changing. God was doing something in me. I was at a crossroads moment in my life. I had started to do more and more music and performing in high school, and that was leading me down certain roads and into certain friendships. And throughout that week at camp, I felt like God was talking to me. Each night we'd have a service, we'd have a speaker, we'd have music and singing and worship and prayer around the altar. Really powerful emotional times for teenagers who are already powerful and emotional, right? But God was stirring something in my soul. And one of those nights at the end of the week, I didn't go up to the front at the end of service. I just sat there in my seat alone and just prayed silently. I didn't have much choice. I didn't have a voice. And I just began to ask God and say, Lord, if you want me to use whatever gifts and abilities you've given me for you and you alone, show me. Tell me. Let me know. And then I just waited there. Nothing happened. After a while, I got up. I went to the front, joined my friends there praying at the front, the altar. And everyone, you know, was all excited and emotional. But for me, it was a sober moment. I was really just waiting. God, I want to hear from you. What do you want from me? And then I felt someone tap my shoulder. God? No. Not directly. It was the guy who'd been the speaker all week. He had reached down and was just tapping me on the shoulder. When I looked up, he handed me his microphone and told me, come up here. And then just pointed me to the team that was leading the music to go and just sing with them. So I walked up and joined them and thought, okay, let's see what this is like. Never heard a frog sing before, but here we go. And I started to sing, and as soon as I started, my voice was fine. Fine, I mean, maybe not great, but I could sing. I could sing, and I sang for song after song after song, and I was able to stand there and do that. I walked away from that moment feeling like I saw Jesus in that moment. I experienced his presence in my life in a powerful and personal way that left a mark on me. But I also know, looking back now, almost 40 years later, I didn't fully see Jesus that night. I'd caught a glimpse. He had spoken to me really clearly, in a unique way that I can't say has happened any other time in my life quite like that. But I hadn't fully seen Jesus. I had so much to learn about who Jesus is. And it's been years, it's been almost four decades of Jesus working on me to clean away the crud in my eyes to help me see him better and better. And I'm sure however many more decades I've got on this planet will be spent still with Jesus cleaning the crud out of my eyes so that I can truly see him. And I'm not the only one who has difficulty fully seeing Jesus. We all do. Jesus' disciples, who spent every waking moment with him for 3 years, struggled to see who Jesus truly was. They'd seen him perform all kinds of miracles. They'd even gotten in on the act, and he had done miracles through them, praying for people, seeing them healed. But they still struggled to see who Jesus was clearly. And so at one point, Jesus took them and they went across the Sea of Galilee and escaped back to where Peter and Andrew and some of the guys came from, a town called Bethsaida. And Jesus said, let's get away from everybody. I want to spend time with you guys. Because he knew that what was about to happen next was he was about to head down to Jerusalem for the last time where he'd be killed. And they got to the town and everyone heard they were there. So people started to show up, including a blind man and his friends. We don't know how the man became blind. Could have been an accident, could have gotten hit in the head, could have gotten something toxic in his eyes. We don't know, and I guess it doesn't matter. If you've been blinded, you're not so much worried about how as how do I see again. And so he and his friends, they brought him to Jesus, and they begged Jesus, please, would you heal him? And Jesus took the man and led him aside, looked into his face, and spit in his eyes. I used to get annoyed at that air puff thing they used to do at the eye doctor. Jesus spit in his eyes and then touched his eyes and then said, what can you see? And the man struggled and he said, I see men and people, but it looks like they're like trees walking around. His eyes were all blurry still. So Jesus put his hands on his eyes again and then took them away and said, what about now? That's why your eye doctor does that, by the way. How about now? How about now? And he said, I can see everything clearly now. I can see your face, Jesus. I can see the pores on your face. I can see that bird over there. I can see that little thing running on the ground. He could see perfectly and clearly. Now, that's a weird story. It's weird because there's no other place, there's no other situation in Jesus' life where it took two shots for him to heal someone. Even when he raised Lazarus from the dead, Lazarus was dead. And Jesus walked up. He didn't have to put on a show, scream and shout. He just said, Lazarus, come on. And Lazarus left that tomb alive. So what's going on here? Was healing this guy's eyes so much more difficult than raising someone from the dead? Or was Jesus trying to teach his disciples a lesson about something? Everything Jesus did, he did with purpose. There's a lesson Jesus wants them and you and me to learn about what it takes to see him clearly, what it means to see him clearly. Seeing Jesus made a real difference in that blind man's life, wouldn't you say? To go from being blind to seeing, that changes everything. Jesus changed a lot of people's lives for the better by healing them. But Jesus didn't come to put Band-Aids on our lives, to just get us through until the day we finally die, and then that's it. And Jesus came to do something much bigger. He came to save our lives by healing our souls. But as it turns out, it's easier to see Band-Aid Jesus than it is to see the soul-saving Jesus. It's easier to accept and want and desire Band-Aid Jesus than it is to accept and want to see the one who reaches into my soul. Let me show you. Right after Jesus healed this blind man, he took his disciples and they got away from everybody. And he began to talk to them and he asked them, okay, who is everybody saying that I am? What are they saying? And the disciples told him, well, some people think you're John the Baptist. Other people think that you're one of the prophets like Elijah, risen from the dead and come back to lead us to God and make us repent and all that. And Jesus said, okay, well, what about you? Who do you say that I am? Peter jumped in there. He got first place, first comment. And he's like, you're the Messiah. Total confidence, without a doubt, you're the Messiah. Which sounds like, right there, Peter's high point, it sounds like Peter's the first person to ever really see Jesus for who he was, the Messiah. Only this wasn't. Because Peter's definition of Messiah is very different than Jesus' definition of Messiah at this point. And that's about to cause a confrontation between the two of them. I want you to watch what happens as Jesus begins to tell them the kind of Messiah he was going to be. So in Mark chapter 8, verse 31, Jesus says to them, or Jesus begins to teach them from that point on about what would happen to him. He says, he began to teach them that the Son of Man, which is another name for the Messiah, must suffer many things, must be rejected by the elders, rejected by the chief priests, rejected by the teachers of the law, all the important religious officials and leaders of Israel, and that he must be killed, and 3 days after rise again. Jesus spoke plainly about this, and Peter pulled him aside and rebuked him for it. No, 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 Jesus, stop. You're getting this all wrong. This is not how this story goes. When Peter said Messiah, what he pictured in his mind was, we're going to roll into Jerusalem in power. You're going to convince all of the religious leaders of Israel that you're the one, and I'll be there, the first follower right at your side. And once we've done that, we will turn and confront Rome, and we will throw them out. They will no longer occupy us, and we'll be restored to God's nation again, and things will be what they should be. That's what you're supposed to be saying to us, Jesus. I didn't sign on for failure. I didn't sign on to go and lose my life and be killed for nothing. That's not the Messiah Peter wanted to follow at that point. Turns out Peter wanted what many of us want, what most people want when they first see Jesus. He wanted Band-Aid Jesus. He wanted Jesus to come and fix up the situation and the problem as he perceived it to be, as Peter perceived it to be. So to Peter, Jesus was really blurry. He looked like a person, looked like the Messiah, but he couldn't really distinguish Jesus for who he really was. So what we thought was one of Peter's great moments is actually one of his lowest, because then Jesus turns around, faces the disciples, and rebukes Peter and says, "Get behind me, Peter. Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the things of God. You have human concerns in your mind." It's much easier to see the Band-Aid Jesus, to see the Band-Aid Jesus versus the soul-saving Jesus, because all our eyes are focused on our surface concerns. Even as you walked in here today, even as I walked in here today, thousands of surface concerns you and I are worried about, even in this moment. Those consume our vision. God sees the root of our problem. We don't want to deal with that, the soul problem. Fix all this other stuff, Jesus. So we close our eyes to who Jesus really is, and we say, "You know what, Jesus, I'm just going to trust you to just make everything good in my life. And then you just do it, Jesus. I trust you. I believe in you." We call this blind faith. "I just believe you're going to do it, Jesus. I don't have to look." And really it is, "I don't want to look, Jesus, because I know you're going to call for something out of me." A lot of people think being a Christian means having just blind faith in Jesus. They've never read what Jesus said next then, I guess. Because Jesus is not looking for people who will follow him blindly in exchange for him taking care of the things they're worried about. He's looking for people who will let him open their eyes, who will see him for who he is, and who will follow him with eyes wide open. Listen to what Jesus said next. Then Jesus turns to all the crowds that had gathered now with the disciples, and he says to everyone who can hear, who wants to follow him, "Whoever wants to be my disciple, I know all of you have come here because you've seen the miracles I've done, but listen to me. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and lose their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul?" Jesus spelled it out really clearly for us. We get confused because we don't see him clearly, but he spelled it out clearly. He didn't come to put Band-Aids on our lives. He came to save our souls. I don't know what you hear when I say the word souls. I don't know what you picture in your mind. You picture something floating around? The brilliant Christian philosopher Dallas Willard was once doing an interview, and someone asked him to explain what our soul is. And I love the way he explained it. He said this: "The soul is the deepest and most vital part of the person as a whole. It's often treated as the person." We do this when we talk about saving our soul. Well, you know, we don't save our soul and leave our emotions and feelings and our body and all the rest of it out. This is just a way of talking that emphasizes the soul is so fundamental that we can, in some cases, treat it as the whole person because it, listen to this, it actually is the thing that integrates all of these aspects of the self and makes them work together. When our souls are broken, the integration of our spirit and our body, our minds, all of it, it's also broken. We don't do what we know we ought to do, and we do things we know we shouldn't do. We become disintegrated, dysfunctional. This is life as we live it, because we are soul sick. And Jesus came to save us at that deepest level, to heal us at that deepest level. And that healing isn't easy. The cost is incredibly high. And everyone who wants to be healed and really see has to submit to the whole process of healing. Jesus described it in three ways. The first thing he said is deny yourself. If you want to see Jesus, if you want to follow him and experience this relationship with him, the first step is deny yourself. This doesn't mean you should stop letting yourself have desserts. This doesn't mean that when you go home, you should go find that extra chocolate bunny you bought and hid from your kids in your bedroom and throw it away. That's not the kind of denial he's talking about. Jesus is telling you and me to deny ourselves as the center of our lives. Deny yourself as the center of your life. Stop trying to make the world revolve around you, which is what we're all trying to do. We're all trying to make everything revolve around us. Some of us do a better job than others, but none of us are able to do it. It's an impossible task. And trying to make everything revolve around you immediately puts you in competition with everybody else around you who's also trying to make the world revolve around them. And that's why there's all this tension and stress and frustration in all of our relationships. We're all trying to make the world revolve around me. That's also puts you in competition with God, who actually is the center of all things. And it fractures your relationship with the only one who can make your soul healthy and whole and right, who can restore your soul. So Jesus says, deny yourself. Deny yourself as the center. The question used to get thrown around a lot, you know, if you want to know what to do, think, what would Jesus do? A lot of us applied that to ourselves, trying to make ourselves be better people. It turns out that many of us were only doing that to try and make ourselves a better person so that we'd have a better person as the center of our life. But we were still staying the center of our life. It's okay, what would Jesus do in this situation? Well, we're not Jesus. We're not living the life Jesus lived. And to try and just make ourselves a better version of ourselves, more like Jesus' version of ourselves, so that we can trust ourselves more to be center, that's not going to work. What we need is to be displaced. So maybe the better question to ask is, what would my life look like right now if Jesus were living it? If I got out of the center and Jesus were living it, what would he do there? Because in my life now, I need to see what and how would Jesus behave and then mimic that. The next way Jesus tells us, if you want to see Jesus and begin to experience this healing in your soul that leads you to see him truly and fully, he says, take up your cross. And remember, Jesus said this weeks and weeks and weeks before he was nailed to a cross. So they would not have pictured Jesus on the cross when he said this. They would have immediately thought of what everyone thought of in that day. When you mentioned a cross, you thought of the Romans and the way they punished people. The shame, the humiliation of being nailed to a cross and hung up there for everyone to see. That's what they would have pictured. Crosses were symbols of Roman punishment and therefore symbols of Roman occupation. With their expectation is, Jesus, come on, let's go and take over and get rid of the Romans. Jesus is saying, I'm about to go to Jerusalem. They're not going to accept me. They're going to reject me, and I'm going to be killed. What Jesus is saying is, take up your cross. He's telling them, come die with me. Come die with me. Not many people want to hear that. We much prefer Frank Sinatra's version. Come fly with me. Come fly. Let's get away. Let's go just take it easy. Let's go vacation. Let's go to Peru. Let's go someplace nice and tropical and have some drinks and just get away from all this hassle. That's not Jesus' call. Jesus' call is to come die with me. There's a paradox embedded in the gospel. And it is this. To live is to die. To die is to live. To lose your life is to find it. To try and grab hold of your life is to have it slip through your hands. But to put your life in Jesus' hands is to find his life filling you. That's the paradox of the gospel. Weakness and strength. Strength and weakness. Open your eyes and see clearly. The path to life is not by scratching and clawing and keeping yourself the center. It's by the death of every part of you that wants to be the center of your own life. And let God, who is the appropriate center, take his place. See him for who he is. Jesus' last statement here is to follow him. To follow him. Jesus never is the one who stands off in the distance saying, okay, here's my list of things I would like you all to do before I accept you into heaven with me. That is not the picture of Jesus. That is not what God is like, waiting for us all to do things to, oh, okay, I'll let you in. Okay, I'll let you in. That's nonsense. Jesus is the one who went ahead of us, who blazed the trail for us, who did everything necessary to make a path for us to see God and find life. And what Jesus does is not call to us to perform so that we earn this. He calls us to follow him, to walk the path he walked, to walk with him. C.S. Lewis sums it all up really beautifully in a portion from his book, Mere Christianity. He writes this. He said, Christ says, give me all. I don't want so much of your time and so much of your money and so much of your work. I want you. I have not come to torment your natural self, but to kill it. No half measures are any good. I don't want to cut off a branch here and a branch there. I want to have the whole tree down. I don't want to drill the tooth or crown it or stop it, but to have it out. Hand over the whole natural self, all the desires which you think are innocent, as well as the ones you think are wicked, the whole outfit. I will give you a new self instead. In fact, I will give you myself. My own will shall become yours. Seeing Jesus clearly is the result of this process of healing. This process is not comfortable, but it will save and restore, heal your soul. You will see Jesus. You know, I think about and I worry about, you know, what if that blind man, what if he had stopped short once Jesus spit in his eyes and said, whoa, 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 this isn't what I was expecting, Jesus. This is not what I want to have to go through in order to see clearly through this life. Or what if, you know, he had accepted just that first touch, you know, I'm okay, Jesus, blurry vision, this is enough for me, I can get by with this. I'd really not rather not see you totally clearly, because then I know that's going to start making demands on my life. That's going to call for me to change my behaviors, my actions. It means I'm going to have to step out of the center and you'll be there. That means I'm going to have to walk the path you walked, and that doesn't seem fun. Have you seen Jesus, though? Jesus calls us to this, to not stop short. To not stop short of partial healing, to not settle for walking around blind to him. Jesus calls us to come, to step up to him. Have you seen Jesus? Not the Band-Aid Jesus. We need to put that aside and see Jesus for who he truly is. Yes, he cares about our needs. Yes, he cares about healing us and restoring us and making us whole. He cares about the things you worry about. But the root of it all is the sickness of our soul, our sin. That's what Jesus most cares about. If you deal with everything else, but don't deal with that, it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It doesn't change a thing. You may feel a little bit better for a moment, but nothing has actually changed. You're still sinking. Jesus wants to change the trajectory of your life. That may mean you're still going through all kinds of trouble, because it was trouble on the way down. It's going to be trouble on the way up and out. But the difference is now the trajectory has changed. And we're walking with Jesus through this path he blazed, because we see him clearly, because we heard him say, come. He's calling you this morning. You may feel tired. You may feel weary. You may just be, life is beating you up. You may also feel hungry and thirsty for something, because nothing is satisfying. Maybe you've achieved a lot, but you're realizing none of it's really been satisfying. Maybe you're feeling guilt and shame over things you've done this past week or 20 years ago. Maybe you feel like you don't understand how it's even possible that Jesus could save your soul and heal your soul. And you don't get it, and it's just confusing. And there could be a million reasons why you might hesitate to step up to Jesus and ask him to heal you. But he still invites you. The best reason to come to him is because he stretched his arm out on that cross and died for you and invited you to come see him, know him, follow him. That's what he's called.